dark days in Venezuela, literally, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Venezuela is broke, power outages are common, consumer goods are scarce, and the government is in complete chaos.
This makes the U.S. Congress look like a cocktail party.
Okay, that is bad. Plus, a Kurdish representative in the U.S. says she's been preparing for the job since childhood.
I was 11 years old, but I think politically I was probably 28. And I used to talk about world affairs. I used to talk about Kissinger, and my 11-year-old friends didn't know who Kissinger was.
And an Australian singer finds inspiration in a Chinese science fiction story.
It's a metaphor. I guess it's sort of disguised in the ramblings of a madman who thinks that everyone around him is eating people.
That's all today on The World. Glad you could be with us on this Friday. It almost seemed like old times in Baghdad today. A U.S. Secretary of State flew into the Iraqi capital for meetings with local leaders. John Kerry's message, though, today, the U.S. will be bringing even more pressure to bear on the so-called Islamic State, or Daesh, as Kerry calls it.
We will continue targeting and taking out Daesh's leaders, and we will train local forces to take and hold more ground.
Iraqi Kurds are watching this closely. They're on the front lines of the fight against ISIS, specifically their Peshmerga forces. Bayan Sami Abdulrahman is the Kurdish representative here in the U.S. She came to our studios today and told me that there is progress in the fight against ISIS, but big problems remain, like the hundreds of thousands of refugees now living in Kurdish-controlled northern Iraq.
Our population is about 5.5 million. This is a huge influx of people. It means that our services are all stretched. Electricity, which used to be 24 hours a day, now is maybe half that. Healthcare, our hospitals are bursting with people who need attention. Everybody is struggling. We are struggling, and the refugees and the displaced.
Well, I was going to ask you, Bayan, how do you lobby for these causes in Washington, a city that's already deeply distracted by what's going on with the refugee crisis in Europe?
You know, the refugee crisis in Europe is obviously linked to what's happening
Sure.
in Iraq and Syria. And unless you give the refugees and the displaced something where they're already based in the Middle East, of course they will give up and go to Europe. If I may give you some examples, because the UN has been struggling to raise money, enough money, to really deal with the humanitarian crisis in Kurdistan and Iraq, the financial vouchers for the people in the camps have diminished. The food basket has shrunk. 55% of the children, the displaced children in Kurdistan, are not in school. Now, if you're a parent, you see there's not enough food on the table. Your children have been out of school for 1 or 2 years. Of course, you'll give up everything and try to put everyone on a boat, risk their lives to go to Europe.
People are fleeing because of violence and extremism, and I know the impact of terrorism is something that's personal for you. You lost both your father and your brother in an attack some years ago. Tell us about that and how it affected your life. In fact, I would guess changed your life.
My father and my brother were killed by Islamist terrorists. It was a suicide bombing, and in fact, almost 100 people died. It did change my life. We sort of sometimes thought that our father might be killed because he was in the forefront of the Kurdish movement.
Right.
He and my mother were sentenced to death by Saddam Hussein. He was a Peshmerga in his early days. So I think the possibility of my father being killed was always in the back of our minds. But I didn't expect my elder brother, who was only 3 years older than me, to be killed in that way. In the way it changed my life is that it galvanized me to be more proactive, to serve the people of Kurdistan. You know, I want to say this, if I may. People always ask me about their death, but I remember their lives. You know, my father struggled almost his entire life for the freedom movement, to liberate the people of Kurdistan from genocide, from oppression, from Saddam Hussein. My brother did the same in his own way. It's their lives that inspire me, not so much their deaths.
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, you're technically a representative, but you're kind of this ambassador, almost activist. That's kind of the role you served. You do that because you had family members who died as a result of extremism.
I was born into a family that was very active in the Kurdish liberation movement for two or three generations. So I think I just grew up in that atmosphere of knowing what was happening. You know, by the time my family moved to Britain, I was 11 years old. But I think politically, I was probably 28. Mm. And I used to talk about world affairs. I used to talk about Kissinger. And my 11-year-old British friends didn't know who Kissinger was. So I think when you grow up in that atmosphere, when you know about your rights and that your culture is denied, your language is denied, that your father has been sentenced to death because he challenged the president of Iraq or vice president at the time, you grow up in that atmosphere. So I think you just are much more aware of what is denied you and what you should fight for.
Let me ask you this. With ISIS in Iraq, with the U.S. occupation of Iraq over, but plenty of unsettled and destabilizing factors in the wake of that occupation, what do you tell people who wonder if the days of stability under Saddam Hussein were better days?
I would challenge that they were stable. Maybe they looked stable from the outside, but from the inside, you had a regime of utter terror. There was cruelty, violence, all done under silence. So, and this was the days before the internet and mobile phones and so on. So people didn't know what was happening. Iraq became the theater for repeated acts of massacre, mass murder took place in Iraq repeatedly. Iraq launched wars against Iran and Kuwait. In the Iran-Iraq war, about 1 million people were killed on both sides. What kind of stability are people talking about? And I would also challenge the concept that Iraq's history began in 2003. It didn't. Iraq is about 90 years old. Since the beginning of that nation state, we have had coup d'etats, we have had bloody revolutions, we've had violent transfers of power from one government to another, we've had genocide against the Kurds, we've had huge massacres against the Shia population. What kind of stability are we talking about?
If Iraq is to be unified again, tell us why the North, Iraqi Kurdistan, should be separate.
Well, I've just explained the kind of nation-state Iraq has been. From our perspective as Kurds, first of all, we were not asked if we would like to be part of Iraq. Second, Iraq immediately turned into an authoritarian regime and then eventually a brutal dictatorship. And today we have an Islamic State taking over about a third of Iraq. So what have we seen? What gains have we benefited from by being part of Iraq? We have seen nothing but chemical bombardment, oppression, violence, and cruelty. We've had very little. Even today, we are fighting ISIS. We are not receiving a budget from the Baghdad government, and we're receiving very little assistance from the Baghdad government. So, you know, if you talk to the younger generation of Kurds, the ones who were born after 1991, they don't speak Arabic. They prefer to learn English. They feel that Arab Iraq doesn't want us. They question the leadership. Why are we part of Iraq? They don't want us. Why don't we just go free and rule ourselves?
So yesterday, my barber asked me who I was going to be speaking with today for the show, and I told him about you, and his reaction was, wow, a woman is the Iraqi Kurdistan representative to the U.S. And I think some people would be surprised by that, because a lot of people tend to paint the Mideast with this brush that puts all women in an abaya. Why should we not be surprised by a woman representative ambassador from Iraqi Kurdistan? Educate us for a second.
Well, first, I'm not the only female representative. We have 14 representatives abroad altogether. Currently, two of us are female, used to be three. We also have ministers who are women. And the first Kurdistan parliament was created in 1992. Even in the first parliament, we had female members of parliament. Now we have a quota system. Minimum 30% have to be female. In fact, the real number is more than that. I think we have made a very conscious effort to encourage equal opportunities. Over time, particularly after 2003, when we opened up to the world, we've learned more about how to stamp out gender-based violence, how to promote women's rights. I'm not saying it's perfect. We still have many, many issues with regards to women.
Well, we can't forget about those women Peshmerga fighters. I mean, if those videos are for real, can I say badass in front of an ambassador?
Definitely, they're badass. And actually, thank you for reminding me, there have been Kurdish female Peshmerga throughout history. That isn't new. Even when, you know, I was a young child in the 60s and 70s, we used to carry pictures of female Peshmergas. They were our heroes. So this is not a new phenomenon designed for Western consumption. I don't want to paint a picture of harmony and perfection, but you cannot, for example, compare the status of women in Kurdistan with the status of women in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or anywhere like that. We're far ahead of them, but we're not anywhere near Sweden or Canada.
Bayan Sami Abdulrahman, Kurdistan Regional Government Representative to the United States, thank you very much for coming by today. It was great to meet you.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Let's turn to another part of the Middle East now. In the past 6 months, a wave of Palestinian stabbings and attacks against Israeli soldiers and civilians has followed a pattern, according to Israeli authorities. A Palestinian stabs or tries to stab an Israeli. Israeli forces then shoot the Palestinian to stop the attack. And that's what the Israeli army said happened 2 weeks ago in the West Bank city of Hebron. Then a video surfaced. Daniel Estrin reports from Hebron, and I should warn you, the beginning of this story is graphic.
It's almond season in Hebron, but amidst the blossoming trees, there are borders, divisions, checkpoints, and 2 weeks ago, an execution. This video on YouTube shows medics treating an Israeli soldier who was lightly wounded in a Palestinian stabbing attack. A Palestinian man, Abdel Fattah al-Sharif, lies face up on the street. The army says he was shot taking part in the attack. He moves his head a bit. Then another soldier nearby raises his rifle. He shoots the Palestinian. Blood streams from his head. That was the shot that killed him. And it was captured on video by another Palestinian.
That's when I realized that moment, exactly, is a moment that when I realized this is worth recording and it's dangerous.
Imad Abu Shamsia lives on the street where this happened. He rushed back to his house, sent the footage to an Israeli group advocating Palestinian rights, and it was posted on YouTube. The soldier was arrested by military police. His name is under gag order. His lawyer says he shot the Palestinian man because he feared he could set off a bomb. But Israeli leaders have denounced the shooting, saying it does not reflect Israeli military values. Then the tide began to turn. The Palestinian videographer got a threatening phone call from an anonymous man.
He talked to me and said, "You will regret having taken that footage."
And he says while he was giving an interview to an Israeli TV channel, he was attacked by a group of Jewish settlers from the neighborhood, including Baruch Marzel, an ultranationalist leader. He lives just up the hill from the Palestinian videographer. In a second video, Marzel can be seen walking up to the soldier who shot the Palestinian and shaking his hand. When I sit down with Marzel, he tells me he didn't know at the time that the soldier had shot the wounded Palestinian.
If I would know he's the guy that killed the terrorist, I would hug him and kiss him, not only shake his hand. If someone comes to kill you, kill him first. That's a Jewish value. It's a sin not to kill him.
Marzel is usually on the fringe. But this time, large groups of Israelis across the country have rallied in support of the soldier. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the soldier's father to offer sympathy for the family. It's become a national story, but in Hebron, it's very personal. This is a place where Marzel can walk up to a soldier who shot a Palestinian on his street and shake his hand. It's a place where Marzel greets soldiers passing by his house, offering them his bathroom. And it's a place where a short walk past a couple army checkpoints and some almond trees, a Palestinian sits in his yard and tells the story of his arrest by the very same soldier in question. It was just 1 month before the shooting, and surprisingly, he has nice things to say about him.
For the first arrest in my life, I was not humiliated, I was not attacked, I was not beaten, I was not blindfolded.
Issa Amro is an activist who preaches civil disobedience against the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. He's frequently arrested by the Israeli army. He calls them political arrests. Last month, Amro says, the soldier in question watched over him from 1:30 in the afternoon till 10 at night.
We talked about everything. We talked about sport. We talked about his girlfriend. He was talking to his girlfriend all the time. I saw him as a normal soldier.
Amro says there have been many instances of Israeli soldiers shooting Palestinians when they posed no danger. This one just happened to be caught on tape. In the video, he thinks he sees the soldier receiving an order to shoot. He thinks the army has turned the soldier into a scapegoat.
That soldier is a victim of the occupation because the main system is making soldiers victims. First, sending them here, militarizing them, and then, you know, accusing them that they are acting individually.
In Israel, the soldier is facing trial in a military court. He's accused of exceptional behavior, of doing something that soldiers shouldn't do. But two men on opposite sides of the conflict who have met him personally, ultranationalist Israeli settler Baruch Marzel and Palestinian civil disobedience activist Issa Amro, they see the soldier differently. They see him as a symbol of Israel's might, a symbol of the way things really are in the West Bank. Not an exception, but an example. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Hebron.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Offspring of political leaders who also become leaders. The U.S. is no stranger to that. George W. Bush comes to mind. Same could happen in Peru, which has the first round of its presidential elections this Sunday. Keiko Fujimori, daughter of former President Alberto Fujimori. Right now, he's sitting in jail for rampant corruption during his tenure as Peru's head of state. But Keiko is a favorite in Peru's election. Reporter Simeon Tagle is in Peru. So with elections on Sunday, what's the mood, Simeon?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Peru right now is rather divided. Fujimori, Keiko Fujimori, has the support of around 1 in 3 voters, but she also has very high negatives. At least half of all Peruvians say they would never vote for a Fujimori, and that's because of the legacy of her father. On the one hand, he's credited with ending the civil war started by the Maoist Shining Path rebel group. That civil war killed nearly 70,000 people. He also inherited, when he was elected in 1990, an economic crisis that included inflation of 12,000%.
Wow, but the methods 12,000%.
Basically, people were spending their money literally as soon as they had it. If you received your pay in the morning, you wanted to spend it that morning, not even wait till the afternoon. But on the other hand, the methods he used and the corruption of his government is really something that many Peruvians just find, even 20 years on, it's something that boggles the mind. $600 million of public money disappeared while he was president. He also engaged in serial human rights abuses, including ordering death squads to carry out extrajudicial killings of terrorist suspects, some of whom turned out not to be related to Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path, at all, and one of whom was an 8-year-old boy. So he's currently in jail for 25 years, and many Peruvians, wonder why on earth would you want someone with that kind of pedigree, the daughter of that kind of president, back in power.
I mean, what is the appeal of her, given that her father had this epic fall from grace?
Keiko Fujimori has been trying to soften the image, and she's talked about not repeating the errors of her father's government. She's also said that corruption attacked his government. She sticks to the script. She also keeps the media at bay, hasn't given any interviews to foreign journalists. But really, her appeal is really based on her surname. I mean, if it wasn't for that surname, I doubt she'd be running for president at all, never mind leading the polls.
Has enough time passed that the daughter of Fujimori gets a pass now?
For some Peruvians, yes. I think it's also interesting, though, that there is a hardcore of Fujimori support, or Fujimoristas, which is maybe 20% of the population that were always going to vote for her. They've just never accepted the negative part of the Fujimori legacy. What I think has happened over time, though, is that she's then built on that another 10-15% of people who either have fading memories or are young enough that they don't have memories at all of the 1990s. And she's done that really through this, repositioning ideologically of her party.
If Keiko Fujimori becomes president, will she free her father, who's now in prison?
she has said she won't, and I think politically she needed to say she won't, because that's a red line for a lot of voters that they just won't cross. An awful lot of voters just simply don't believe that. They expect her to do it, and the question for them is really, is she going to do it as soon as she becomes president, if she becomes president? If not, I mean, how long will she wait? I mean, he's got almost, I think it's something like another 17 or 18 years of jail time to serve. He's 77 as well, by the way. One possibility is that she does some kind of fudge and decides to pardon him on humanitarian reasons, saying that he's in ill health.
Right.
I think that's a possibility.
I suspect you'll be out taking the pulse of things on Sunday. Is turnout expected to be high?
Well, it has to be, because voting is compulsory here.
Mm.
So there's always a very high percentage of people who vote.
Reporter Simeon Tagle speaking with me from Lima, Peru. Have a great weekend. Thanks.
Thank you, Marco.
No election in Venezuela, but the country is in the middle of a severe recession, and some people there are blaming President Nicolas Maduro. His government is also in chaos, deadlocked in a crisis with an opposition-controlled Congress. Hannah Dreyer is the AP correspondent in Caracas. It kind of sounds like a perfect storm, Hannah. I know Venezuela is an oil powerhouse, but now there are also energy shortages. What is that about?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing that the country that has the world's largest oil reserves basically can't keep the lights on. The government says that what's happening is a drought has caused problems at the country's largest dam. And it's true that rainfall is down here by about 15%. But most experts say that really it comes down to a lack of infrastructure, a lack of maintenance over the past 10 years or so. And now the government is having to resort to some pretty desperate measures to try to keep its capital city functioning.
So that dam that runs on hydropower, is there no connection between the oil production and electricity?
No, they're separate issues.
Mm.
But Venezuela should have enough money to maintain its electricity grid. At least that's what the experts say.
Right.
But in fact, we've seen these chronic shortages for years and years. At one point, President Maduro had the lights go out during one of his presidential addresses from the presidential palace.
Yeah.
And now with the drought, things are getting even worse.
I gather President Maduro has come up, though, with some creative answers to help cope with the shortages.
Right. So Venezuela likes to sell itself as a worker's paradise. And now it's implementing a 4-day work week for all public workers. They've also taken measures like closing down malls early. And this week, Maduro asked women to stop blow drying their hair and to just let it dry naturally. He thinks it looks nicer that way.
Oh my gosh, what did he ask the men to do?
The men are asked to not iron their clothes, which I think most women would say is far less of a concession.
You're not a public employee, so no day off for you. Have you been cutting back on hair dryer use, or do you not even use one?
Like most Venezuelans, I'm learning to live in the dark sometimes. My power has been cut 4 times in the past month or so. And this week I woke up with no lights and didn't even occur to me to think maybe I hadn't paid my electricity bill. But 10 hours later, I realized I hadn't. So I paid it and got the lights put back on.
Wow.
But it's just a fact of life.
Right. So President Maduro can't do much about these problems with the opposition controlling Congress. As you say, there's a deadlock. And we've seen these deadlocks here in the States and Washington, including furloughs. How bad does this get when it happens in Venezuela?
Yeah, this makes the U.S. Congress look like a cocktail party. What's going on right now is Congress, which is controlled by the opposition, and the presidency, which is controlled by the Socialist Party, are trying to destroy each other. So yesterday we had President Nicolas Maduro saying that he might shorten the congressional session to just 60 days. And Congress is saying that it wants to recall Maduro before the end of the year.
And President Maduro is talking about a new revolution if he doesn't get his way. Is anyone taking that seriously?
That's kind of the discourse of the socialist revolution here. It's always a new revolution or a strengthened revolution.
So there not a huge surprise?
Yeah, there are still some people, polls say maybe about a quarter of the people here who really support the revolution and are probably excited by that discourse. But the majority of people probably aren't even watching Maduro. They're waiting in line at the supermarket or they're wondering when their power is going to get cut again.
Hannah Dreyer, AP correspondent in Caracas, Venezuela. Thank you very much, as always.
Thanks, Marco.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. The Paris-Roubaix cycling race is this Sunday. It's a grueling 160 miles of bad roads across northern France.
This is a road race. It's just a road race on fiendishly bad roads. It's a race that riders either really love or completely detest.
Riders gear up for the hell of the north ahead on the world.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Joy of Love, that is not some new self-help title that's hitting bookstores this weekend. No, The Joy of Love is what Pope Francis is calling his latest apostolic exhortation. It's a 256-page document offering the pontiff's thoughts and recommendations on matters related to love. Inez San Martin was one of the first people to get a copy. She's the Vatican correspondent for Crux, based in Rome.
Well, Marco, if you don't mind me saying, making a quick summary of what Pope Francis brought in 260 pages is almost an unachievable goal. But okay. Let me put it this way. Pope Francis wrote about the family, and he left basically absolutely no issue untouched. From the role of women and men in the family to what happens with Catholics who have divorced and are civilly remarried who currently cannot receive communion, absolutely no issue was untouched. He even spoke about female genital mutilation.
Yeah, so that shows just how wide-ranging this whole document really was. What was the tone of it? Was it supportive of families, regardless of how people see themselves in a family?
What Pope Francis is trying to do with this apostolic exhortation is trying to reach out to every family in the world, whether you're actually Catholic or not. He's trying to say that the church welcomes you. He's trying to say that God's love reaches you no matter what your situation.
Yeah, and yet same-sex families, he pretty much definitively closes the door on that kind of arrangement.
Yes, he definitely closed the door to same-sex families. That's Catholic teaching. Two men and two women do not constitute a family, again, in Catholic teaching. And Pope Francis, yes, closed that door.
So if you take the liberal members of the Catholic Church and the conservative members, how have they viewed this?
Well, there has been different reactions all around. For example, in the liberal camp, there were some that were very happy, very appreciative of the fact that Pope Francis seems to have opened the door to Catholics who have divorced and are civilly remarried on a case-by-case situation. But on the other hand, those same people in the liberal camp are upset at the fact that Pope Francis wasn't as welcoming with gays and lesbians, you know, as the Synod was perceived to be. The Synod is a gathering of bishops from which this document was based. There were actually two held in the last 2 years, and there were several documents coming out from those synods. And those documents talk about gays and lesbians, something the Vatican hasn't done before those synods. Yet today on Pope Francis' exhortations, we don't see gays and lesbians. We see homosexual people, and we see people with same-sex tendencies. So in that sense, the liberal camp is disappointed. On the other hand, the conservative camp is, of course, disappointed on what happened with the divorce and the remarried, because even though Pope Francis didn't fully open the doors, he did leave a space for doubt, or what he called discernment. So in that sense, both sides, I think, got something, and neither side got everything they wanted.
So I gather these synods were pretty contentious. Are we looking at a diluted version of what Pope Francis really wanted?
To tell you the truth, it's very, very hard to actually know what he wanted. There's a joke in Catholic Church which says that not even God knows what a Jesuit is thinking. Huh. Pope Francis is a Jesuit by formation. So at the end of the day, it's very, very hard to know just how far did he want to go.
So ultimately, Inez, how is this going to affect divorced and LGBT practicing Catholics? I think that's what a lot of our listeners are going to want to know.
When it comes to LGBT Catholics, I think it has very little impact. I've had the opportunity to talk to some of them to try to sense their reaction, and most of them are actually disappointed at the fact that they didn't see as much change as they were hoping to see. When it comes to the situation of the divorced and remarried Catholics, it's very important to say that it all comes down to a very specific case-by-case situation. It could very well be that many Catholics who are currently in a second union will have access to communion after a path of prayer and penitence, what is called discernment.
What do you find most interesting about this document?
there's something very specific that caught my attention, and that's the fact that some of the most important elements of it are actually not in the body of the text, but in the footnotes. There are two very specific footnotes on Chapter 8 that are the ones that open the doors for the divorced and the remarried to access the sacrament, but it's not in the body of the text. That was very interesting to see and caused a lot of confusion today when I was talking with different colleagues here in Rome, and they were saying, well, nothing happened, and others were saying, yeah, a lot happened, and it all came down to have you read the footnotes or not.
Yeah, an editor at the Vatican would have said they were burying the lead.
They most definitely were burying the lead, but, you know, it still made my lead.
Inés San Martín, the Vatican correspondent for Crux in Rome. Thanks very much, Inés.
Thank you.
Here's a sobering thought to chew on. Researchers believe that roughly a third of all the food we produce is never eaten. That, of course, is a huge waste of resources and energy, and it has a big impact on climate from the emissions related to all that wasted food. Meanwhile, hundreds of millions of people go hungry. As economists might say, it's a massive market failure, but it's also one that a lot of people are trying to change. You'll find some of them at an obscure new restaurant in Paris. It's part of the Freegan movement, which, in case you didn't know, is all about salvaging, free of charge, discarded but perfectly good food. Here's reporter Adeline Sia in Paris with the second of her two stories on climate-related changes in the French diet.
Head to the last stop on Metro Line 7 in Paris's 19th arrondissement. Walk across a giant, grimy square and look for a tall set of metal doors under the highway overpass. When you see the bright green painted pony, you'll know you have arrived at the Friggin' Pony restaurant. It's a restaurant and an illegal squat set in a cavernous dark space, and it's as urban gritty as it gets, furnished with long wooden tables, sofas and cushions, and dim lights. The space has been serving 80 meals a night, four nights a week, on a pay-what-you-wish basis since it opened last November, and its menu is basically created out of food that's too old to sell, but still good to eat. That's the idea behind the name, Freegan. I've been feeding myself like this for years, says Aladin Charny, who heads the non-profit restaurant with a team of volunteers and paid chefs. Not because I have to, he says, but because of my political convictions. I find our way of consuming and throwing out food is totally absurd, as if it had no value. Charny harvests most of the food for his restaurant from the huge Rungis wholesale market on the outskirts of Paris. There, tons of food reaching the end of its shelf life is thrown away every day. Meat, dairy, seafood, and produce. Charny is mostly interested in produce, since Friggin' Pony is strictly vegetarian and sometimes vegan. In the kitchen area, Chef Santiago Rosero is working with today's ingredients, starting with potatoes.
I'm going to make a thick potato soup from my country, from Ecuador. And I had the idea to make the lentils in a risotto way with some pickled and roasted vegetables. And for dessert, I see that there are apples and bananas, so I'm going to try to make something with that.
Nearby, pastry chef Francis Leach is making shortbread.
Flavored with a little bit of orange zest and a little bit of pepper. And it's to go with the apple compote.
Many of the dishes have an ethnic flavor to them to cater to some of the restaurant's usual clientele, homeless migrants, whom Friggin' Pony regularly invites in to eat and even sleep in the space. Most are Afghans, like Sultan Ali Tavakuli, who's dining tonight on a fragrant Afghan stew.
It's rice with potato and with pea. That's nice.
Bon appétit.
Merci, pareil.
Friggin' Pony has staked out some unique territory among Paris restaurants, but it's not alone in addressing the issue of food waste. A new law here in France requires supermarkets to donate unsold food. But founder Aladin Charny says most food waste comes from the wholesalers, who are not covered under this law. That's why Friggin' Pony goes to the wholesale market to reclaim food that would otherwise still be thrown away. Of course, the randomness of what's available can make for some interesting challenges. American expat Marty Hartzog is one of the cooks here.
I arrived once and all we had was cabbage and 50 kilos of parsnips and a bunch of oranges. And so then you just have to start getting really creative. It did end up being mostly a soup, but then I also made a really nice sauce with some overripe persimmons. So sometimes you get inspired by things you didn't think were possible.
And now and then, Hartzog says, she's got enough ingredients to make something truly elegant, like her most recent dish.
A white bean and lentil salad with oranges and fresh parsley and mint, and some roasted zucchini and a little bit of sesame seed served with endives. So that was pretty nice.
Judging from the thumbs up at the tables, tonight's meal is a hit with the 80 or so migrant patrons. And as the evening progresses, there's even a party atmosphere. Now, for all its good intentions, the Friggin' Pony restaurant is still illegal, and the local court has moved to shut it down. But founder Aladin Charny says he's hopeful they'll be able to work something out with the city. And no matter what, Charny says the group will keep finding ways to pursue its mission to reclaim wasted food and turn it into elegant cuisine. For the world, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
Let's talk now about something that's consumed by creatures in the ocean, krill. Antarctic krill, specifically. These are tiny shrimp-like crustaceans, and they're a critical link in the ocean's food chain for whales, penguins, and seals. And there's a growing movement to protect Antarctic krill, because krill oil with omega-3 fatty acids is touted as a kind of wonder drug that may help with heart health, cholesterol, even our moods. But as the world's Jason Margolis reports, a group of environmentalists is trying to get the world's largest pharmacy to pull krill oil from its shelves.
Let me give you a sense of just how small krill are.
Each blue whale needs 40 million krill every single day to survive.
That's a lot of krill. Glenn Hurwitz directs the Lifeline Antarctica campaign, a coalition of organizations working to protect the waters surrounding the southern continent.
Our vision is to make the Southern Ocean the last refuge that's free of commercial and military exploitation. Part of that means not sending these huge ships with vacuum cleaners that suck up krill to the Antarctic Ocean.
Krill populations in Antarctica have dropped by 40 to 80% in the past 30 years. It's not just from overfishing. Krill also needs sea ice, which is retreating as the climate warms. With fewer krill, two species of penguins are in rapid decline, and Antarctic blue whales have been pushed closer to extinction. Hurwitz and his coalition are trying to bring attention to this by targeting the world's largest pharmacy, Walgreens, and its omega-3 krill supplements. The group has held meetings with Walgreens executives, picketed stores with people dressed as penguins, and produced adorable krill cartoons. The Save the Krill movement also has a powerful Washington ally, recently retired Congressman Henry Waxman. The Democrat from California, dubbed the Elliot Ness of his party, spent 38 years in Congress taking on big tobacco, big food, and big polluters. Now he's got Walgreens in his sights.
If countries need to act responsibly, businesses need to act responsibly as well. And the omega-3 supplement can be made without using krill.
Retailers like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's are selling omega-3 supplements made from fish oils and algae. Besides Walgreens, Costco, Walmart, Target, and CVS also sell krill oil. But Waxman says targeting just Walgreens is an old labor strategy. Go after the most influential player.
My father was a member of the Retail Clerks Union, and they would picket only one store, one chain, and then get a contract with all of them.
But is Walgreens feeling the pressure? A company spokesman, Jim Graham, said via email that nobody was available for an interview. He said Walgreens krill products are certified by the Marine Stewardship Council, a nonprofit that works to encourage sustainable fishing. Several leading environmental groups fiercely criticized that certification. It's not hard to understand why Walgreens doesn't want to pull a popular product. The omega-3 supplement business is worth billions. Andrew Hoffman researches business sustainability at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. He says companies try to stay one step ahead of the competition on environmental issues, not two.
You think about it as a wave and it's cresting, and you want to move just ahead of the competition, but you don't want to move too soon if you find yourself out there all by yourself.
On the other hand, if a company catches a wave by itself, by doing something good for the environment, that can send a positive message to customers. Hoffman says judging when to move is more art than science.
I think the key factors are there high visibility players that are calling attention to this issue that will draw media attention? And certainly a U.S. Congress member would drive attention to this issue. In the mere fact that we're having this conversation right now, would it be happening if the congressman wasn't involved? It's a good question.
Of course, many environmentalists aren't concerned about Walgreens' quarterly profits. To them, protecting the planet should be the bottom line. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. In cycling, there are road races, and then there are these epic one-day races known as monuments. One of them is the Paris-Roubaix, which takes place this Sunday. 160 miles through the French countryside, with sections paved with cobblestones the size of river rocks. And if it rains, these cobblestones get really slippery. Tires puncture, riders crash, bicycles are snapped in half. Seriously. That's why they call it the Hell of the North. All of which makes the Paris-Roubaix special, according to Ian Austin. He covers cycling for the New York Times.
It's only really been a monument since the late 1960s. It was one of many 19th century races. It was started to promote a velodrome. But by the 1960s, people had kind of lost interest in it. And the organizers of the tour organization decided they introduced a novelty that made the race this place in history. And that was to find the worst, most beaten down farm lanes, which were paved with these breadloaf sized pieces of cobble, and include them in the race.
Wow.
From 1968 on, that's what made it a monument.
So in the 19th century, what were they riding on then?
Well, they rode on cobbles, but everybody rode on cobbles, right?
I mean, that's how roads were.
Yeah. And of course, after the war, you know, the cobbled roads were gradually paved over. So by 1964, they were down to about 22 kilometers of cobbles, but they weren't the cobbles we see now.
Right.
You know, they were slippery, but they weren't wildly deformed. Now the pave roads, and there's about, well,
and
depending
pave,
on what
the cobblestones, right?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, yes. There'll be about 53 kilometers of them. Now they're actually protected. Like, it's the most bizarre thing. There are these roads which are, their deformity is protected by law.
Still, that's about 30 miles on cobblestones. How do the riders handle them, especially when they're wet?
Well, you know, wet or dry is equally bad. When it's dry, the dust makes them slippery too. Plus, you can't see. Plus, you're choking on the dust. I mean, the dust is unbelievable. But this is going to be the first time since in 14 years we've had a rainy, muddy Paris-Roubaix. So everyone's going to look pretty disgusting, look like they've come out of a cyclocross. So it's a race that riders either really love or completely detest.
And I heard that they don't even stop trains for the Paris-Roubaix race. That can't be true.
They never stop the trains for races. The riders are supposed to stop. This leads to both disputes about fairness from the riders who got stopped by the train and monumental stupidity involving riders trying to cut in front of trains as they're barreling down the tracks.
So how is the popularity of Paris-Roubaix growing in the U.S.? Is it getting American riders?
The one thing that really made Paris-Roubaix is that they introduced the cobbles at the same time that cycling became broadcast on television regularly in Europe rather than being shown in cinemas a few days later. Mm. So it is, as anyone who in the 21st century looks at it on YouTube can see, it's pretty spectacular TV. So there's always interest from teams and from the American teams to have riders up there.
So why is Paris-Roubaix your favorite race?
Well, somewhat contradicting myself, it is, you know, it is kind of an anachronism. It has no place in modern cycling. Bernard Hinault, the arguably the last great French champion, hated it. I mean, he said it was a stupid race. It was a race for beasts. But he did win it in 1981, and he never finished lower than 13th.
Why did he think it was a stupid race?
Well, he just thought it was too dangerous, too crazy, too anachronistic. I guess I'm a nostalgic, and I like the anachronism of it, and it has a sort of vitality and a dimension that no other race has.
Ian Austin covers cycling for the New York Times. Thanks very much, Ian.
Thank you, Marco.
Finally today, a musician from Australia with not your run-of-the-mill story. She said something I did not expect to hear when I asked her where she got her inspiration.
I was attracted to Chinese science fiction because I consider myself a folk singer.
That's right. For Australian singer-songwriter Kelly Dance, her inspiration, the allegories and far-fetched stories of Chinese sci-fi. Kelly Dance was introduced to it at her local library in Hong Kong. She had moved there in 2013, and one story she picked up in Hong Kong was Madman's Diary by a writer named Lu Xuan. The story was first published back in 1918 and inspired Kelly to write this song, Dangerous Visions.
Rid ourselves of polluting what is. Don't sit idle to watch hostile forces. Take a position in public opinion. Rumors end with wise men.
It's a metaphor. I guess it's sort of disguised in the ramblings of a madman who thinks that everyone around him is eating people. And that obviously is a wrong thing to do, and he's trying to highlight that that's a wrong thing to do. But the arguments that he's getting back is, but it's always been this way. So it's a story that challenges, you know, people to question what they think to be true, even if it's wrong.
Now, you were reading this in a library in Hong Kong. Were you surprised to come across the story?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the thing that attracted me to these stories is that they, and as you say, this one was written 100 years ago, Chinese science fiction for me was a way into understanding the culture, because I think that this story and actually the other Chinese science fiction stories that I've read highlight a rebellious spirit that I hadn't ever associated with China.
I think of one of the great pieces of Western sci-fi, 2001, A Space Odyssey by Arthur C. Clarke. And one of the big lessons was that technology will overtake humans if we're not careful. Also that humans really want telephones where we can see the person we're speaking to, and that's come to pass with Skype. What does Chinese science fiction tell us about the China of today, do you think?
I think for me it is that rebellious spirit in China that I had never associated with it before moving there. And I think that it also sort of points to, even though a lot of these stories are dystopian, they usually involve people, like-minded people, finding each other to get to the truth or to try and find what's right despite what the consequences. And so for me, that revealed a kind of optimism and, you know, an optimism for future possibilities.
Well, the whole notion of kind of people, like-minded people finding each other, that is kind of the overarching theme of the title track, All That's Gained, on your EP. It's based on this science fiction novel, The Fat Years, a whole month that's been erased from people's memory. But then there are a few people who find each other, who know about that lost month, and they get together.
That's right. That despite the consequences, we will still seek to find the truth.
Truth weighs uneasy in the face of fortune. And fortune smooths the wounds in the madhouse.
That song is All That's Gained. It's the title track from the debut EP by Australian singer-songwriter Kelly Dance, an EP inspired by her love for Chinese science fiction. And that is our show today. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
And it's live or die together.
PRI, Public Radio International.